being the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and welcome you all. Mr. Rocco has some preliminary comments about the binders before us and other organizational type comments. So, Mr. Rocco.
Thank you, Mr.
Welcome.
Chair. Ken Rocco, Legislative Fiscal Office. The first two items on the posted agenda will not be dealt with today. That was organizational items on adoption of rules and appointment of the fiscal officer. Progress has been made on the rules, and I think hopefully next week we'll have rules in place at a subsequent meeting. You'll see in front of you budget binders. And there's a variety of them there, and those are going to be used on one of the items of the agenda today, some instruction on what to look for in those budget binders. So those are just samples for you to look at when we get to that agenda item. And I also wanted to note that we're going to hand out to you a follow-up answers from the treasurer from your meeting last week. So we'll be passing out answers to those to some of the questions you had of the treasurer last week.
All right. Thank you very much. On the agenda today, the first item is Mr. Warner with the revenue outlook that a lot of you have been hearing about, but we thought it would be very helpful as we proceed with budgets to have the latest information. Well, Mr. Okay. Warner, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Officer. Earlier this week, I had shared with the co-chairs what we're seeing in terms of revenue collections coming in on the income tax. And, of course, I'll emphasize that the forecast process by the Office of Economic Analysis is we're pretty much in the middle of that process. They have meetings today with their advisory councils, and the March forecast will be released February 28th. So that would be 3 weeks from today. One of the things we have recommended to the state economists is they give you a monthly report, a monthly update, and they've begun that process, and they have sent that out to you based on the December numbers that they saw through the fourth quarter. Those numbers actually track very close to the revenue forecast done in December. In fact, they're only about they're within 2 million of those estimates on personal and corporate. So we interpreted that as a positive sign and certainly a change in the way things had been going prior to that. However, we do have a daily report from the Revenue Department. As dollars come in, they issue what's called a banking report. And we do have some trends for January that we thought are strongly indicative enough to bring to your attention that the March forecast, there is going to be some further downward pressure on the March forecast. And let me walk through with you what we see happening. And what I've copied off for you really is it looks like very preliminary kind of information, and it is. But it's the daily information that's coming in, so you're up to date with what we're seeing. The first page there I have stapled together is Oregon Department of Revenue Banking Unit. And the key thing in that corner is the date on it, that first page, is 1/31/02. So I'm comparing with last year. So I'm looking at the revenue for last year. And what I've circled for you is about halfway down the page there, estimated tax. Taxpayers who don't have withholding, don't have an employer withholding their income taxes, make quarterly estimated payments. So these are usually small businesses, can be investment income, rental income, various things that don't have an employer withholding those dollars. And you'll notice that last year through January, collections were $187 million in the bank at the end of January. Now, if you turn to the next page, and I've got the next full page there, the banking unit dated 1/31/03. Which would be the front of the second page. And again, about halfway down, looking at that same column, that same heading for estimated tax, you'll notice is $146 million. So in 2002, at the end of January, we had 187 million. This year, we've got 146. So a drop of 41 million compared to the prior year. Now, the estimated taxes, this is basically what we're going to get for the quarter because we've got a January 15 deadline. We're going to get very little more the rest of the quarter until April. So we're looking at that. The other thing I'd point out, the difference between these two banking reports is the withholding tax, which is on the back of the front page. You can see a prior year. Again, it's circled there about $328 million for withholding tax for January collection. The withholding is clearly the bigger component and nearly always is for every month. Now, if you look on this back page of the banking report dated 1/31/03, down near the bottom of the page, you can see then withholding, we got 330. So I think that's probably about as good an indication you're going to get what's happening in the economy. It's flat as a pancake. It's not growing. Okay, so we're not seeing year-over-year kind of growth that we've seen traditionally in the income tax. And that, I think, is probably very consistent with what you're hearing from the business community. Now, if you look at those two numbers and then turn to the third page, I've Xeroxed off a copy of the details of the December revenue forecast. Okay, and this is in the back. It prints out all the numbers that sum up to that final number that you get. And if you look at the column in the lower right-hand corner, there's 2003-1. That's 2003 first quarter, the assumptions for the first 3 months of this calendar year. You'll notice, first of all, on estimated payments, that the projection was $225 million, or 7% above last year. Okay, we just saw that most of our estimated payments are in the bank, and they're about 25% below last year, about $40 million. So we know that that's clearly trending off what was assumed in December. The other thing I would point out is that I didn't circle that, but the line just above it for withholding is $945 million for a 3% growth rate, and we've seen in January we basically have 0% growth. So we're not getting any offsetting gains there on the withholding side. I think it's important to recognize that the percentage growth assumptions here for both the first and second quarters, the last two quarters of this biennium, are overall the totals, and I've circled those at the bottom, are about 16% for the first quarter and 21% for the second. And those numbers seem very aggressive, but keep in mind that if you look back on the prior year, we were down 16% and 21%. And the forecasted revenue is actually still below what we received in those two quarters in 2001, 2 years ago. So the message here is that we're not seeing a recovery yet in the income tax, and we anticipate there will be further downward pressure on the March forecast. It's too early to give you any kind of a number on what that'll be. That process is to work itself out, and the state economist will produce an objective estimate for you based on this information that's coming in. But this is to give you some early warning that estimated payment trend in particular indicates that revenue is tracking under the December forecast. One final point I'd make is one of the questions that Co-Chair Schrader asked me was, well, how does this compare with December of a year ago and what we were seeing happening? And that was kind of instructive to look at that. This was when you were going into your first special session. And personal income taxes in that last column there show the difference between the December forecast and what actually happened. And you can see that actually income taxes were a little above the December projection for the quarter. It was corporate that was so far below. And actually the adjustment was made going into the second special session was on the corporate side. I believe it was down about 150 for a total. But my point in this is that in March of of 2002, we were unaware of the drops that occurred when those collections came in April. And it was the June forecast that picked up the big drop, because that picked up the filing season, the April 15 filing season, where you do you get the big swings. Refunds can be greater than projected, and payments can be less, and those, of course, combine to reduce net revenue. So there's still very much a risk out there for the May forecast, and regardless of what you see in March, I think you have to keep in mind that the spring is traditionally the riskiest time where you get the biggest swing.
Thank you. Are there questions, Representative Morgan?
Is there any discernible impact that anyone can see from the fact that we've told people not to file their taxes early because of the Measure 28 election?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, I think that could cause some effect on those returns coming in, and we'll just add another element of making it tricky to interpret them. I don't think it had much effect on those estimated payments. Those quarterly payments are done really primarily driven by federal concerns, meeting those federal deadlines. So I suspect the estimated payments are not really affected by Measure 28.
Thank you.
Additional questions? Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Paul, built into these numbers, is this the recovery of the Measure 66? No, Measure 88. Anyway, when we took those away in the third special session, are those numbers at $108 million, is it built back in here?
Senator George, Mr. Chair, there's a couple things about Measure 88 here. One is that we do have a bump in the forecast based on the assumption that Measure 88 revenue is going to start coming in. I believe it's about $40 million expected to be coming in that first quarter. So first and second quarter where we expect that impact to be, as we see the Department of Revenue adjusted the withholding tables last year to reflect the full Measure 88 as it passed, the going from 3 to 5,000. So that was to reflect current law at that time. Now, during the third special session, when you changed that and phased it in, they did not adjust the withholding tables back. So we think what's happened is some people were probably under withheld relative to that new law, and so we'll get most of that. In the first 6 months of this year, we'll see that effect of your decision in the third special session. The withholding tables will be adjusted, by the way, starting March 1st to reflect it for the 03 tax year.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
And
well, I think the committee continues to appreciate the difficult task we have and why it's so important that all of you are going through the presentations of the different agencies with respect to their priorities and what we might have to react to in the event that the forecast doesn't improve. So I appreciate the committee's understanding and hopefully the public's understanding of the task we have. Now we've got Sue Wilson. Let's talk about position reclassifications.
I'm sure she does.
Yeah. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sue Wilson. I'm Acting Administrator of the Human Resource Services Division in the Department of Administrative Services. I was invited by your legislative fiscal officer to do a basic overview of the reclassification process in state government, mostly in response to questions that have been arising in your subcommittee hearing, budget hearings. And so I have prepared a two-page, which I think is being passed out to you now, that I'd like to go over. And again, this is a basic overview, and I will respond to questions the best I can. And if we need to follow up with some other things, I'll be happy to do that too. Before we talk reclass specifically, I want to give you just a little bit of context about how reclasses occur and what they occur in. In essence, a little bit about the classification system. A classification itself is a group of similar job duties and qualifications that are brought together with job positions that have similar levels of responsibility and skill and knowledge needs. An example that I give you in the memo is that of an office specialist 1. Not every person classified as an office specialist 1 will do the exact same job. However, all the duties that are performed by an office specialist 1 will fall within this larger classification and will all be done at approximately the same level of work. So reclassification itself is a business tool that we allow state managers to use to make the best use of the resources they currently have available to them without coming to ask for additional resources. The need for position reclassification is driven by a business need in an agency, and that business need results in the work of an individual being changed. This change has to significantly alter the duties and responsibilities of that particular position. Now, there's a number of business reasons why this can occur. If there's changes in a business process that takes place and emphasis is on a different area of a process that might require a different level of skills and abilities for an individual, that might put their position and that grouping of skills and abilities matching closer with a different set of skills and abilities. If the work assignment is changed due to reorganization, if an agency reorganizes, they may find that they are moving personnel around and changing the responsibilities of some of that personnel. There often are new laws and rules implemented that require an agency maybe to focus on different priorities. Focusing on those may require a different level of skill and ability for an individual. Agencies can propose a reclass or participate in a reclass process through the Department of Administrative Services if and only if they can show that it can be financed by the agency within their legislatively approved budget limits and salary limits. And also they have to show that it will not produce any future budgetary increases. If they cannot meet those two criteria, then any reclass request would need to come through the legislative body, either the emergency board or through ways and means. Sometimes those will show up in policy packages and as part of the budget review. On the back of this page, I have tried to do a chart which sort of walks you through the steps that an agency would have to do in order to pursue a reclass. First of all, they need to identify the business need that's out there. Secondly, the agency's own human resource staff will look at the job duties, the changes in those job duties, and most often will do a desk audit and actually go out and see what it is the individual is doing and the work that's being doing that individual is doing in relation to the job. They then prepare an analysis or a review of that and make a recommendation on whether or not they think the job has changed significantly enough to match a different classification group than the one it's in. Having been in agencies, I can tell you that a lot of requests and interest in reclasses die right there because of the agency internal review process that says, no, that job has not changed significantly enough to warrant a change to a different classification. Agency management then needs to make a determination on whether or not they have the ability to finance that particular reclass. Again, having experienced this in agencies, it is not at all unusual for a potential reclass to go nowhere because the agency simply can't finance it. If they can meet those two things and it makes through that review, then a budget reclass package or a reclass package is sent to budget management. Budget management package must include the letter requesting the action and why it's needed, the finance plan, very specific finance plan on exactly where the financing is coming from, an organization chart of the program, the new position description, and the review that was done by that agency human resource person. When budget and management receives that request, they look at it from a number of different perspectives. First of all, does the reclass align with what the program is supposed to be doing, given what the legislature has indicated the program is to do? Secondly, does it include an adequate finance plan? And at that point, they may refer that particular reclass package down to Human Resources Services Division to take a look at the specific job duties that are in that reclass to see if it matches the classification allocation that's been done by the agency. There's a lot of reasons why those come down, and more we are looking at nearly all of the reclass packages that are out there. If something doesn't look quite right within the organizational chart, it will come down to Human Resources. Anything salary range 38 and above, we must review. And we did find that during this interim, any of the policy packages that included a reclass package did come to Human Resources for us to review to make sure that was the appropriate classification. And any of the reclass packages that came through this interim to the emergency board, we also did do the reviews on those. Human Resources, like I said, takes a look at the position description, takes a look at the classification where the job was, takes a look at the new classification and says, yes or no, those job duties better fit in which of these classification groups, and then send our recommendation back to the Budget Management Division. Budget Management can then go ahead and implement and make the change in the personnel system, or if we don't all agree that it's a package that meets all the criteria, it will go back to the agency as a denial. That's the basic reclass process. I'd be happy to try and take any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions?
Questions?
Co-chair, do you have one?
Thank you, Mr. Vice. Chair. Mr. Vice. Sue, thank you. I'm just trying to get a feel for, there's two types of actions, ASS approves or the legislature approves.
Correct.
Which SE board. Just what are the numbers of each type, say, for maybe the 01 budget year or some kind of period of time?
That's a very good question and one that I asked myself.
Okay, so I don't need the answer today, then, is what you're telling me.
I can tell you that overall there were 1,045 reclasses in the 2001-2003 biennium. That's a little less than 3% of the positions.
To date.
Yeah, I have. That was 2001-2003, so, yeah, to date. I have asked the same question, and I haven't been able to get the data on whether those reclasses went through the DAS package, the e-board package, or were part of the budget package in the 0103 budget okay. development. We have to go back, apparently, to the paper records to find that out.
Okay. At your leisure, we'd appreciate it.
Okay.
The reason for the question is, do we have something broken that we need to address, or is this thing working okay the way it is? And I'm hearing both sides of the story, obviously, but we need some data before we can
address my I'll be happy to get that.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are the legal ramifications, if any, if a reclass is denied because the fee increase was denied, and that's how they were going to pay for it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, technically, if a reclass is denied at the legislative end, saying that we acknowledge the need but we're not going to give you the finances to be able to do this, there's a number of different options that can occur. An agency can try to work within the funding that they currently have, or they can remove some duties from the particular class so that it goes back to the original class and fits within the classification that already exists.
Thank you.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a couple questions. One, and I want to distinguish between line reclassifications and management reclassifications.
Okay.
How many management reclassifications upward occurred after the first special session? And walk us through after the second special session, the third special session, the fourth and fifth. Because it was stated that if they had it within inside their budget, you know, they had the discretion to go ahead even if their position work had changed. And I think when we were going through budget crisis and actually reducing budgets, whether we did in fact have some reclassifications of management going upward. The second part of the question is, and if that occurred, how wide was the scope of change in their practice? Was it because they actually had more people to supervise? What triggered?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I do not have numbers broken down by date in that extent, and I can follow up and follow the dates in this, in relation to the special sessions for you.
And could you also give us a list of those agencies who implemented upward reclassifications during this particular period of time?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, can I clarify, during this particular time, well, being around the special sessions?
Yeah, what I'm looking at, we were in a budget crisis, and in budget crisis, when we're all asked to actually conserve and when we're all saying that we're cutting services, and yet if we're having reclassifications upward of certain entities within inside the building, I just kind of think that that's a serious problem, and I know they did. Some of them did not come to the e-board or to ask for those that justification. And you know, we're talking about what's happened in this environment during budget crisis, and so that's why I want to try to track and follow which agencies did in fact had major, reclassifications upward. And what was the scope or the reason that they had to have reclassification, particularly in the area of managers, where we always have that caveat, duties as assigned.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have a question about the second box on the chart, in that human resources staff review of the request, it says it may include a desk audit. could you describe what constitutes a desk audit and how is the determination made to do one or not? And
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, every agency obviously is going to have its own processes to a certain extent in terms of the resources that they have available to conduct a desk audit. But a desk audit basically includes having a human resource analyst work with the individual in the position and the manager of that position to say, what are the duties, what is the work that you're doing, to actually see the interaction that's going on and to outline and analyze the work that's being done. I would say that in many cases, agencies usually try to do this. There may be some cases, for example, with a reorganization, where it may be fairly obvious what's changed, especially if it's a large one, and not desk audits may not be conducted on each and every one. But I know there is an attempt to do that.
Thank you.
Okay. Did you see basically more reclassifying take place as a result of the budget crisis we've been in? And maybe with layoffs, you're spreading that responsibility around?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, again, I haven't broken those down by timelines within the biennium, but I think that would be very interesting to do. I do know that it does appear, just from the data I've been able to gather just recently, that we did have fewer reclasses in 0103 than we did in 9901. Okay. Now, the reasons for that, I really don't know.
Okay. Thanks.
Senator Devlin.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that this number would be relatively small, but could you get for us the number out of that 1,000-plus reclassifications? Occasionally, the duties of physicians diminish, and the reclassification should be down rather than upwards. Could you get us the number for how many reclassifications to a lower range there were?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I do have the overall number for that. Of those, there were 93 that were reclassed downward, and there were 98 where it was a neutral reclass. They went from a classification of the same level.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Betsy.
Thank you, sir. I'm not familiar, and you may not know the answer to this question today, but given the restructuring of the Department of Human Services, and I think as that restructuring is happening, some of us haven't been able to follow the details of it. But I'm making the assumption that if there are reclasses within program areas inside the department, that those reclasses stay in the program area. for example, if you have a reclassification that happens in seniors and persons with disabilities, that the money to accomplish that reclass occurs in that program area rather than, say, drawing money from the Commission on Children. And I'm just looking for reassurance that it happens within those silos, given that I don't know the full magnitude of the implementation of the restructure of DHS.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, there is a provision, yes, that it has to, you can't go to outside or other funding sources. This has to be within the same program funding sources. Now, how that translates to DHS and its overall reorganization, because things were moved a great deal, I don't know, but I can get you some additional information
on
that.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that.
Ken, did you have anything to add? Are you on the agenda? I don't know how much you could add to this one. This is great.
Mr. Chair, all I wanted to do was, after Sue went through the process that is used for reclassification, I just wanted to give you an idea of what options you have as you when you see a reclass package in front of you in a budget proposal.
Okay. Any further questions for Sue? Thank you. That was super. That wasn't so bad, was it?
No.
These are nice people.
As Sue mentioned, when you have a reclassification package in front of you in an agency budget, it's there because they have not been able to do it through this permanent financing mechanism. And what they're doing is asking you for either funding or the authority to spend other funds in order to make that reclass happen. So when you have one of these before you, you have three options, basically, that are listed in the memo that you just received. You can approve the package, including the funding and the new position allocations. You can approve the position allocations or the new classification, but you can deny the funding. And by doing this, you're directing the agency to find resources within its budget to go ahead and make that reclassification. When you do that, you only get savings for you get it for that budget cycle, because after that, the position is automatically rolled up at the higher level for the subsequent biennium. So it's you make one-time savings if you do that course. If you reject the package entirely by denying the funding and denying the agency's ability to change the positions, then there are some options of what you should also do. You can direct them to find permanent financing if they want to continue with the reclass, or you can suggest that they change work assignments amongst existing staff to avoid the need for a reclassification. You can ask the agency to conduct a review of their organizational structure to see if they can find any operational efficiencies anywhere, or you can suggest that they return later to the emergency board to request a new position to address any kind of workload that they can't shift between existing positions.
Thanks, Ken.
You're welcome.
Reading a budget binder. I'm sorry, Sheila. I've got Tootie Smiths here. I can't probably read this one.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Sheila Baker, Legislative Fiscal Office. I was asked to help you understand how to read a budget binder. Some of you are very experienced at the Ways and Means process and have seen lots of these binders, and some are newer and may need some orientation. So I would, at the outset, say that although you will have budget binders at your seats during committee hearings, generally that's not the document that you will be using as we work through the agency budgets. The presentation material that's given to you from our office, from the Budget Management Division, and from the agencies is predominantly what you'll be referring to during the hearings. On occasion, we may refer to the budget binders, but the budget binders do provide both agency summary information and some additional specific detail that you may need as you look at your options on the agency budgets. I would also like to make it clear that although the Budget and Management Division outlines the content of the budget binder in general detail and how the budget binder is supposed to be put together, you will see some variation among agencies, both in where they might put one piece or two pieces, or the level of detail and discussion that's provided in that agency binder. So, as with a number of things in life, the actual results may vary as you get into the individual binders. But some of you have Board of Medical Examiners. Some, I think, have Board of Nursing, and there's maybe another board up there. We wanted to give you a substantive binder, but not one that would overwhelm you, for example, Department of Transportation or Department of Human Services. So, and let me say at the outset, I will not answer any questions as to the details of the agency budget. I'm talking about the format of the binder and the material that's in there. So if you open the binders, the first page, there may be a cover page, but there's a table of contents close there too. The first couple of pages are just introductory information, table of contents, a certification that's required to show, yes, indeed, the agency did submit this budget to the legislature. You will see at the bottom of the pages there's little footers that say agency request, governor's recommended, legislatively adopted, and then the page numbers. That you can look at the bottom of the page and see what iteration of the document this is. Basically, agencies put together their agency request and then update it for the governor's actions and then the legislative actions. So they produce three different budget documents at various phases of the process. The ones that you will have before you in the subcommittee will be the governor's budget version, and agencies will have updated their agency request information for what the governor's budget includes in it. The first tab should be legislative action, and this is a useful compilation of the budget bills from last session that affect the agency, the special session bills, and any emergency board actions that were taken for the agency, so that if the agency does this right, you should have all in one place that information that you can go to. See what their budget was last year, what budget notes may have been included in the agency budget, and any other particular details of actions during the interim. The next section is the agency summary, and this includes good information on the agency overall. There's a graphic of their budget is supposed to show some comparative data, sources of funding, things in pictorial form as opposed to the computerized reports that you'll see later. There is to be a mission statement and a statutory authority. This is under the agency summary tab. Do we have an agency that hasn't included this information? People are looking puzzled. After the graphic display of the budget, there's to be a budget narrative section that has a mission statement and statutory authority, background information, a discussion of the board's or the agency's statutes, goals, responsibilities, the environmental factors that they're looking at. And then there's discussion of the agency plans, linking those to the benchmarks. What budget management has asked agencies to do is to develop 2- and 6-year plans or goals relative to the Oregon benchmarks. So there should be some discussion of that there, which will be useful background as you're looking at the performance measures in the agency budget hearings. There's a discussion of criteria for how they've developed their 2003-2005 budget. And then there's some discussion of links to the Oregon benchmarks and the performance measures. Generally, what you get in your presentation materials from the agency in terms of performance measures will probably be the same as what's in the budget binder. but they may have updated it depending on what their timing is and when they come in front of you or how they report their performance measurement data. But there's more detail here in terms of the length of those performance measures to the benchmarks and goals that is useful information. Then there's a form, it's called a summary of the 2003-05 budget. And this is basically a crosswalk to show you how the agency got from their 01-03 ledge adopted budget to the current governor's budget. And just to make sure you're finding this, it looks kind of like this. You may, again, depending on how verbal or verbose the agency is in their discussion of performance and benchmarks, it may be 2 pages in, it may be 20 pages in.
Mr. Chair, this might be a good example of, I've asked my co-chairs that when they're giving this, to refer to the page that they're looking at, which publication or which paper, and are we in the same sequence? Because what happens is we spend about 2 or 3 minutes shuffling trying to find where we are.
For those of you that have Board of Medical Examiners, it's page 43 in their book. For the others, you're on your own. After that summary, there is to be a display of reduction options, and most agencies will have titled this House Bill 3182 Reductions, because from the last session, there was direction that agencies specifically provide certain information about these reduction options, and so you'll see those for the agency. Now, keep in mind that what's in the budget binder likely was prepared possibly as long as a year ago, and so some of these reductions may have already been taken, and you'll get updated information in the subcommittees as you're looking at those agency budgets about what reductions have already been taken and what would in effect still be on the table from this reduction list. And then to wrap up that section, there's some organization charts showing both what is current organization chart for the agency and then what the agency is proposing for the next budget period. And then that is followed by Orbitz, the new automated budget system information. And rather than trying to walk you through all of that Orbitz information system detail, I would suggest if you're interested in getting into those reports that you talk with the legislative fiscal office analyst for that agency, and he or she can help walk you through those, because they are presented in such a way that they walk you through the actions that were taken, but there's a lot of repetitive or summarized information in them. Generally, if you go to the last page of a report, it will give you the summary bottom line information. And there are two reports in this section. One is a history, if you will, from 1999-2001 actuals through, at this point, the governor's budget. And then in the next iteration of this document, you'll see the legislative adopted budget number. So that's an agency summary walkthrough of that history. And then there's a by-program unit or budget structure piece report that does the same walkthrough but just slices and dices the numbers a different way. So that's what should be in the agency summary section. The next section presents revenue information. There's some narrative explaining where the agency's funds come from. It's supposed to talk about what assumptions are made in building the agency's budget. And then if there's any fee changes, there's some discussion of that. There's some graphics that agencies may include there. And then there's a form that's called Detail of Lottery Funds, Other Funds, and Federal Funds Revenue that provides you some comparison information across the biennium from 99, 2001, again through governors recommended, to show the various types of revenues that the agency may have. Now this and the Orbitz report that follows it, it's line item, but it's line item sort of categorically, and so if an agency collects 10 different fees, you're probably not going to see that broken down in this revenue discussion. It's additional information that you can ask either the agency or the legislative fiscal office analyst to get to a lower level of detail or more specific detail in terms of if you're interested in one particular revenue source that the agency has. But again, this is a high-level summary of the agency's revenues. And you can see general trends. If there's revenue sources they used to have, they don't get any more, or alternatively, if there's new revenues coming in that they didn't have before, that'll help give you a picture of that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, earlier this morning, in a brief meeting with the co-chairs, one of the things that as particularly as we look at the 3182 cuts, I guess the concern that I would have and would express to the members and others would be that as you look at your mission statement and you look at the 3182 cuts, a 10% reduction cut, that somehow those cuts wouldn't be absolutely reflective of any change in the mission. So as we look at the mission statement of the boards that we're looking at to make sure that we protect the health and well-being of citizens, strong ethical counselors or whatever, and then you go over and you see that the very first things that would be cut under 3182 would be immediately dropping all examinations or evaluations of any office procedures and those kinds of things. I look at that and I say, well, that cuts right at the core of the mission immediately. And I look back and I say, wait a minute, here's an agency that's spending X amount of their percentage of their total budget in having meetings and sending their board members off to nationwide and in some cases worldwide meetings. And the very first thing that they're going to cut is a reduction of the investigators and a reduction of the overall examination of the licensure boards that protects the health and well-being of Oregon citizens. And I think that there ought to be some connect between the process of the cuts being relative to the way that the board may function and that the way the board may move around the United States and their continuing professional education and their updates and the management of their office, as opposed to the very first cuts being. And so I guess what I'm saying is to make sure that when you look at those 3182 cuts are don't cut to the core mission of the agency. Just by comment, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. What we're doing now is just making sure everybody has the same baseline information, what these books say and where you find them. What you do with that info, that's where you're headed. I think that's appropriate, but let's get through on what these books are.
The next sections are the program unit discussion. So it's you had the agency summary previous in the book. This gives you more detail on the individual program units. For smaller agencies, there will be one, maybe two particular program units, which is how they build their budgets or how they organize their budgets. For larger agencies, you're going to have multiple program units. But again, this is a more detailed discussion. There's program organization charts there, again, showing current and proposed. There's a narrative that talks about the program description, what they do, who does it, who's affected. This particular one, I'm looking at medical examiners, includes FTE for their major functions. And then there is, by program unit, a display of the essential packages and the policy option packages. So in building the agency's budget, they have a base budget that they start from,
there are what in budget terminology are called as essential packages, which include things like inflation, mandated caseload growth, basically entitlement programs are things that the legislature by policy have considered mandated programs, such as prison inmates. Other program adjustments if they phased in a program or phased out a program during the biennium. And those kinds of things are detailed in the program unit discussions. So you will see some explanation there of what's in those particular packages. Then as the executive branch is examining the agency request budgets, there were additional actions that were taken to update the agency request budget for the special sessions and for other reductions to get to the governor's budget. And so those will also be described for the other funds, licensing boards, which I think you have the budget binders before you. You will not see probably any special session actions other than perhaps the salary distribution. But for those general fund agencies that come before you, you will have an 082 package and the 083 package, numbered packages that correspond to the February special session, the June special session actions. So carrying those actions forward from 0103 actions to their 2003-05 impact. And then the 090 packages would be analyst reductions to get to the governor's budget level. So you will see both a little bit of narrative and then some form presentation of the numbers that are associated with those actions. You will also, if the agency has put their binder together correctly, see a revenue specific to that program unit, a presentation of the revenue specific to that program unit. Now, some agencies may just have one revenue source and it's all general fund, and so you won't see the other fund and federal fund detail. But for those that do have it, you will see revenue detail here as well. And then the next few tabs, depending on the agency, will be the policy packages. Now, these are distinguished in budget building from the essential packages by virtue of the fact that these are things that the agency is asking for that aren't the more routine kinds of ups and downs of a budget. So they're saying we need somebody to make a policy choice as to whether we increase our staff to meet workload, as to whether we do a new information technology project. Those kinds of things would be in a policy package. And so for those policy packages, there's, again, a narrative discussion and then some numerical information about what they're asking for, what kind of budget categories it fits into, what are the position and FTE impacts of those actions. And I will say, at least for the general funded agencies, there may be much more detail on policy option packages in the agency budget binder than you will ever be looking at, because the governor's budget did not move forward most of the general fund policy packages from the agencies. So, for example, in Department of Human Services, in one of my program areas, they had a number of policy packages, and then the governor's budget moved forward like one out of 15. So there's a lot of information in here that you may not even ever need to look at, but it's there if you need it. Then after that information, there are some reports that are required from the, well, let me go back a step. For some agencies, there will be also a capital budgeting section, which if, for example, in Department of Corrections, they're going to be expecting to be building new prisons, you will see some capital budgeting information related to that. If an agency is looking to do some remodeling of a facility that they own as opposed to something that Department of Administrative Services owns, there'll be capital budgeting associated with that. So that's an additional section that will be in some budgets, but not in most of them. And then we get to a
section that's called special reports. These are required reports that agencies have been asked to provide. The affirmative action equal employment opportunity report is part of that. There are reports if agencies are making major changes to their office square footage or something of that nature related to facilities, they're required to report on that. Information technology projects, they're required to report on those. And then if there were Secretary of State audits during the interim, those are required to be referenced and reported on in the special report section as well. Now, again, some of this information you will get additional information or reference on in the agency presentation material, but it is also to be included in the budget binder. And then finally, you will see a section of budget support documents, which are the automated budget numbers, a variety of different reports that, frankly, analysts look at very closely, but generally we hope members don't need to. And those include comparative information agency-wide and then at the program unit level, the line item detail. So if you say, well, how much are the expenditures for rent this time compared to last time, or how much are their publications expenditures this time compared to last time, that's the place where you would find that information. Again, it's easy to get lost in these automated reports because of how they're formatted and the number of pages that are included in there. So if you need some help with those, please get in touch with us and we'll help walk you through those. And the last report is what is called the PPDB PIC system report, and that's the staffing information. Again, at a summary level, how many staff, what kind of classifications, what kind of salary funding do they have? Are they all general fund, other funds, some mix of that, FTE associated with those? So, again, pretty detailed information that we can help you walk through or help you find information if you need that level of information. So, again, in summary, we won't take time in subcommittees walking through all this information. We use it as we help develop our recommendations and as we respond to questions for you. But it is there if you want to walk through it. If you have nothing better to do on a Friday afternoon than read budget binders, they are in the rooms and you can do that. So that concludes my helpful information.
Can't think of a better way to spend Friday.
Hey, great.
Questions, comments?
Question.
Senator Carter.
Sheila, I'm dating myself a little bit, but some time ago, the agencies used to have as a part of their program outlays where a little more information than what I see them today. And I was just wondering, what happened to the fact that when you look at, I do see upstate travel, but I don't see in some of these budgets how much they're spending on, say, advertisement, or how much, you know, they're spending on other detailed kind of things. I don't see as much detail as it used to be.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, depending on what information you want, it may be a subset of a particular budget category, and we, in that case, just have to ask the agency for the information because this is a sort of categorical level of detail, and depending on the agency, you may see, you know, thousands of dollars or millions of dollars in an office expenses line category, for example. Mm-hmm. And if you want a breakdown of what exactly that entails, then we go back to the agency and ask for that. It's not a level that the system reports automatically.
Okay. Thanks.
Further questions? Sheila, thank you very much. In ratification of fee increases.
You've got to go to sleep now.
Mr. Chair, we also today wanted to give you just a very brief overview of fee-type issues. I know there's been some interest in some fee bills or fee proposals that are in front of the subcommittees. Generally, there are two types of fee increases that you'll see this session. One are fee increases that are statutorily set, and they're requests for new increases to fees. And you'll see those generally in a substantive bill. The main example that you may have been hearing about over the past week is for Department of Fish and Wildlife for licensing fees. That's a substantive bill that will be referred to Ways and Means to be worked on in conjunction with the budget. Those fees are set in statute, and once the legislature acts on them, they are in place upon passage of the bill or the effective date of the bill. There's another type of fee increase, however, and I would think most fees set by agencies are done this way, and it's through administrative rule. In 1995, a bill was passed. It was Senate Bill 333. It is now in ORS 291050 to 291060. And this bill basically requires agencies who set a fee administratively during the interim after session's over, basically, to come back to the next assembly and have those fee increases ratified with a bill. So in some of the subcommittees, you have fee ratification bills in front of you. In many cases, this time, from what we've seen, they are licensing board fee increases, for example. If these fees, by this law, if these fees are not ratified by the assembly, they roll back to the level they were 2 years ago, basically. There's on the memo that we've provided you, there's an example of how this works. And I don't want to go through this in a lot of detail, but just to very briefly state this, some agencies may have come into the last assembly and discussed raising fees with the last Ways and Means Committee. That committee tacitly approved those fees by saying, we will provide you with the expenditure limitation that you need during 0103 to spend that additional money that you think that you project you're going to get from this fee increase. So the agencies, through their administrative rule process, then after session went and establish those fees at the new level, have been collecting that fee, have been spending the money, have based their services in anticipation of continuing that fee based on the last assembly's approval of the additional expenditure limitation, and now they're coming back because of this law to get those fees ratified. This is a confusing process, and it always causes problems with the next assembly because there's confusion that these are new fees. And basically they are not new fees. They're fees that have already been established and have already been at least approved through the authority given by the last assembly to spend the money that would be collected by these fees.
Question.
And there's a more detailed example here. So.
Yes, Senator Carter.
I just wanted to run another question. That is a total disconnect between the policy committee and the Ways and Means Committee, which obviously affects the budget. In some kind of way, I would ask that it's more brought into line, because the bad part about it is that the agencies are doing what they've been told by the legislature, but in reality they've not been ratified by this body, the Ways and Means Committee, and so that's confusion for them, and has also put them in a position where they are moving forward on what the policy committee has said, and being slapped on the hand for what this committee has said. Why are you doing this? And so that's a disconnect in this body, the total body, as opposed to in the agencies, and we need to bring things into congruence if this is going to continue to take place.
Mr. Rocco.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, most of the fee ratification bills are assigned directly to Ways and Means.
Okay.
It's only the statutorily set fees that go to a policy committee.
Okay.
And they have a role to discuss, you know, the I don't think they have a role to discuss the level of the fee, but what the fee does and whether those programs are important. But on these types of administratively set fees, those are 5,000 series bills, and they come directly to Ways and Means.
Another question, Mr. Chairman. So, even though it's in statute and cost of living increases and all that kind of stuff take place, they can increase that fee. That is in statute. They can give the permission to increase that fee.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, no. They would have. They can only, if it's set in statute, they can only come back to the next assembly to have an increase. But there are some fees that are set through administrative rule, and they may have a cap on them. They may say that you can set it up to a certain amount, or they just have the authority to increase it to a level that they seem fit. And the administrative rule process is not just them, the board or the commission, saying we are going to set the fee. They have to go through a public notice process and get public input and feedback.
Okay.
Senator George and Senator Gordley.
I think Senator Gordley had her right.
Senator Gordley, then Senator George. Excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. It seems then that we're talking about a process that was put in place in 1995. We now have 8 years of experience that tells us that this is dysfunctional, not working, and there may be an opportunity, or we could take the opportunity to revisit what was thought to be a good idea back in 1995.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I think there may be some room to suggest some changes to this particular law. Maybe not do away with it entirely, but at least for those fees that have been discussed already. In some cases, an agency may not have presented its proposed fee increase to the last assembly, and they may come to the emergency board, for example, to ask not for approval of the fee increase, but again, approval of the expenditure limitation to spend the additional money they would collect from raising the fee. So I think there are some possibilities of refining this a little bit to get rid of some of the confusion. And with the co-chair's permission, we might look into that with the Department of Administrative Services.
Well, as a follow-up then, Mr. Co-Chair, I would request that we do that through the co-chair.
Okay.
Thank you.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Ken, I want to put on my old farmer hat here. And I wanted to have you back up a little bit to where you made a statement that really if we ratify a fee increase that we're not to tell our constituents that we increase fees because of what have occurred before then. But I can't blame the last legislative assembly either because I'm the one who just ratified it. Now, the person who's out here in public land looks at this and says, all I know is I'm paying more money. Now, it's got to be called a fee increase for somebody. Help me understand that.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I think a fee increase is a fee increase, and somebody's going to have to vote for it eventually.
Mr. Chair, I think probably philosophically it may have worked in 1995, but we saw some, on Senator Clarno's committee in last session, we saw some absolute blatant abuses of this, where a particular agency came forward, asked for a fee increase, was turned down, and before the Legislative Assembly was done, administratively they were imposing another fee. And I guess what I see there, and I agree with Senator Gordley, folks, it's out of hand. I mean, if they can administratively change this with the anticipation that we're coming back and we just won't remember. We don't have the institutional memory anymore. And I think it's probably time to revisit it, and I appreciate the co-chairs examining the taking this back up. Thank you.
Senator Harper.
What's the background on why we allow administrative fee increases? Is that something that has always been there, Ken, or is that a
Chair, Senator Harper, I believe there was a time when more fees were set in statute, and there was a, I understand there was a belief that it was to give a little more flexibility to agencies. I think some of the major fees that you see in, like the fish and wildlife fee have been retained in statute.
Mr. Pilcher?
Yes, Representative Bates. It would just seem simple and logical to go back to a system that all fees had to go to the legislature right up front and get it over with. Some agencies appear to abuse this privilege, and that's probably why the 95 law was put in, I'm guessing. Wouldn't it be simpler to say, even though it's time-consuming and difficult, that all fees have to go to the legislature up front?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, I think that would be an option. However, it would increase your workload quite a bit, I believe.
Question of my own. Is there a situation where there would be, is there a question where there'd be some emergency, some problem, unexpected expense, if you will, that would require an agency or board or someone to come forward and need to raise their fees to cover that expense, or can they deficit spend until the next assembly?
No, Mr. Chair, no, they can't deficit spend, and it just comes down to whether they can manage within their available revenue. A lot of agencies are adding services, and they're being asked by their constituencies to add these services, and in order to do that, they have to generate additional revenue. In many of the cases of small boards and commissions, their fees are set in conjunction with their constituent groups, and they're in agreement with how that is. And I don't know how much abuse of this has gone on in the past. I think it's just a convenience way to set the rules through a public process, but not have to have it set in statute. That's all.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think in some cases I've seen situations where agency realized they were going to need to raise their fees, but they didn't know how much, and they wanted to have a conversation with their constituents. And if we were in charge of making that decision, either we would be burdened with having to have the public hearing and the outreach, and in some cases, some of the agencies go through pretty extensive outreach before they do a fee bill. But mostly they want to have that time. But if we were having to set it in stone here, then I think you'd lose the opportunity for the public to really work with the agency in terms of what's the fair amount. Whether or not we could authorize them to go to a certain level and leave that and then let them go out and fine-tune it and have discussions with their constituency groups, that might work. The other one is maybe for them to anticipate sooner that they're going to need the increases and have that conversation before the legislature meets.
I certainly would not anticipate we're going to spend time at public hearings on whether or not a fee, should be assessed based on what the docs want to do, or the veterinarians, or the plumbers, or whatever. I would assume they'd have that hearing first, and then they'd bring that fee request to the e-board once they've gotten their act together and theoretically agree.
Just shoot me in that case.
Yeah, I think all of us probably. All right. Any other issues or concerns?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We focused a lot on the income statements. Will we be looking at balance sheets for the state of Oregon?
Mr. Rocco.
Mr. Chair, I don't believe I will, but you could if we'll get those for you.
And what's driving that question is that if we have declining revenues and we have truly a financial exigency in front of us between now and June 30th, it would be helpful, I think, for this group to understand the balance sheet, assets, fund balances, those that are absolutely protected, those that aren't, so that we have at least some measure of knowledge of how to manage what could become a truly exigent condition.
between now and the end of this fiscal period.
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Morse, what we are doing is we're looking, right now we're collecting information on what agencies have left to spend from their original general fund appropriation in order to make some judgments on potential reductions that are available for the remainder of this biennium. So we are looking at that by agency and by expenditure category.
May I have a follow-up? I guess just for edification, when we're faced with these declining revenues, what role do we now play to manage those changes in the 03 period?
There is a process that the co-chairs and sub-chairs have talked about this morning, trying to get our hands around it. I'm trying to work in tandem with leadership and the governor's office, probably discuss that on Monday, and then you guys will play a very active role. Representative Butler and then Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One thing, and this is intended to be partially responsive to Senator Morris's question, and that is that I have found most helpful, and I've requested these for some of the agencies that we're going to be working with. I found most helpful to have a cash flow analysis, which shows basically the month-to-month cash flow with the existing inflows and those kinds of things, particularly with regard to the special fees and fee-driven agencies, and the boards and so forth, but that we can get a 48-month analysis that gives us a history and that gives you some direction to show whether or not you're accumulating more cash will be necessary or if your cash balance comes down. And that is very, very helpful to know which direction you're going, particularly when you're discussing the fee issue agency by agency as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Depp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to the discussion of fees, I've clearly seen cases where I felt that fees were not warranted if the increases were not warranted. But I think sometimes we lose sight of the original purpose of fees in that the recipient of the service is paying for the cost rather than the general public. That's why there was a movement more towards fee-for-services in the last decade. Also, I want to recall in terms of votes we've had when I was on the House floor on fees and the reluctance of many members to vote for any fee increases, and even I'm not referring to the vice chair. even when the fee increases had the broad support, I can remember a fee increase for inspections of ambulances that literally had the broad support of every ambulance provider in the state and still having problems getting the required votes. And I don't know if we want to get a scenario where, and I don't know if this would be the case, where we would be literally having, I wouldn't say dozens, I would say hundreds of votes on the House and Senate floor on individual fee increases or individual fee increase packages. Obviously, we have some duty to control the escalating cost of fees, but I don't know if we want to get into a scenario where we're going to be voting on every single fee increase. And I recall something that we did a while ago, and I know some people are really interested in this, but when we required all administrative rules to be sent to each of us, and maybe we should conduct a test quarterly to see how many people have actually read every administrative rule that they've been sent over the last year or two.
As soon as we get finished with the budget books, I take us
there. Senator Wright.
I think it's a double-edged sword, Senator Devlin, on the fee issue, because also I remember last session I was receiving calls from individuals who were members and who were paying the fees and said, I didn't advise you to increase my fees. Yeah. You know, your board did it, and we also fail to recognize that when we add fees to our other taxes that are being paid, you know, that also is coming out of the taxpayer's pocket. So to just to say that we can do it through administrative rules, I don't think that's prudent either. Somehow we've got to strike some kind of balance in here, because I'm sensitive when I receive a call from my constituent saying, you know, you raised my fees and I didn't know anything about it. And I'm saying, well, your board did it, or it was done through administrative rule. And they say, well, I didn't send you there to let the board of administrative rule do it. So somehow we have to strike a balance. And I think Senator Gordley's counsel that we began looking at it to see if maybe somehow we can, what we did in 95, make it better. maybe it's time to take a real look at this whole issue again. So it is a two-edged sword, and maybe somewhere there's some room in the middle.
Well, we will, co-chairs will do that, take counsel there, but I would urge you to move ahead with the current structure and let's not hold the process up and use your good judgment as you go through the fees that come through. And we talked with the subcommittee chairs about a little bit about that earlier this morning. They should be able to guide you. All right. With that, thank you for attending. Adjourned.